Vimes was shaken awake. He looked up into his own face, younger, less lined, more terrified.
What? They're bringing up siege weapons, Sarge. They're coming down the street, Sarge.
What? That's stupid. The barricade is highest here. A couple of men could defend it.
Vimes leapt to his feet. It must be a feint. A stupid feint, too. Just here, Waddy and his mates had wedged two big carts across the road, and they'd become the nucleus of a solid wall of wood and rubble. But there was a narrow, low entrance for people to come through, which let them into the Republic, with their head at just the right height for a gentle tap if they turned out to be a soldier. People were scrambling through now like rats. Vimes climbed up the barricade and looked over the top. At the far end of the street, a big metal wall was advancing, surrounded by flaming torches. That was all there was to see in a city without lights, but he knew what it was. It was called Big Mary, and it was mounted on a heavy cart. Vimes had seen it before. There would be a couple of oxen behind the cart pushing it. The walls weren't solid metal, but merely a skin to stop defenders throwing fire at the wooden planks underneath. And the whole thing was simply to defend the men who, behind that cosy shelter, had the big, big hooks on the end of the long chains. They'd fix them in the barricade, and the oxen would be turned around in the traces, and maybe another four beasts would be added, and then there was nothing you could build of wood that wouldn't be pulled apart. Between the cart and the barricade, struggling to escape from the crush, was a mass of frightened people.
"You've got any orders, Sarge?"
said Fred Colon, pulling himself up alongside Vimes. He looked up the street.
"Oh, dear," he said.
"Yeah, this is when you need a couple of trolls on the force," said Vimes. "I reckon the
trolls? Wouldn't work with any trolls," said Colon. "Too thick to take orders."
"You'll find out one day," thought Vimes, and said aloud,
"Okay. Anyone that can't or shouldn't have a weapon, they get back as far as possible, right? Get a message to Dickens, tell him we'll need anyone he can spare, but blast it."
What had happened before? There'd been a lot of activity against the barricades, but it had been a feint while the cavalry were sneaking around outside. He didn't remember this. He glanced at the oncoming wagon. At the top of the wobbling wall, on the other side, there was generally a narrow ledge for bowmen to stand and fire down at anyone trying to interfere with the demolition men. In the treacherous light of the torches, Vimes thought he saw the features of Carsa. Even at this distance, there was something horribly recognisable about that expression. Swing was dead, and when everyone's running around in confusion, a man who is firm of purpose can push his way up by sheer nerve. After all, Vimes thought, I did. They clambered down the barricade and looked at the men.
"I want to volunteer. No, not you, Sam. Wiggly, you'll do. Your dad's a carpenter, right? Well, there's a carpenter's shop around the corner. Run and get me a couple of mallets and some wooden wedges or long nails. Something spiky. Go, 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 go."
Wiglet nodded and ran off.
"And let's see, yeah, I need 2 pennyworth of fresh ginger. Nancy Ball, nip around the corner to the apothecary, will you?"
"What's that any good for, Sarge?" said Sam.
"Gingering things up."
The Vimes removed his helmet and armour and nodded to the gap through which people were streaming.
"Fred, we'll be going out that way. Think you can push the path?"
"I'll give it a go, Sarge."
Fred squared his shoulders.
"We're going to stop that thing. They can't move it fast, and with all this noise and confusion, no one will notice a thing. That was quick, Billy."
"I just grabbed everything, Sarge," panted Wiglet, running up with a small sack.
"I know what you want to do, Sarge. I did it sometimes out of mischief when I was a kid."
"Me too," said Vimes.
"And here's my ginger. Ah, lovely. It brings tears to my eyes. Okay, Billy, ready, Fred."
It took all of Colon's bulk, with Vimes pushing behind him, to thrust a way through the desperate mob into the world beyond the barricade. In the darkness, Vimes forced his way between the bodies up to the side of the siege machine. It was like a huge, slow ram pushing its way down the streets, but jerking forward, slower than the walking pace because of the press of people. Vimes fancied that Carsa probably enjoyed this ride. He ducked under the cart, unseen in the mob, and grabbed a mallet and a wedge from Wiglet's bag.
"You did the left rear wheel, and then make a run for it, Billy," he said. "But, Sarge, that was an order. Get out, get back, get people off the street as fast as possible. Do it."
Vimes crawled up to one of the front wheels and held the wedge ready between wheel and axle. The cart stopped for a moment, and he thrust the wedge into the gap and thumped it with the hammer. He had time for another blow before the cart gave a creak that suggested the oxen were pushing again. Then he crawled back quickly and took the sack from Billy before the little man, with a reluctant glance, scuttled out into the forest of legs. Vimes got a third wedge in before loud voices somewhere behind him indicated that the lack of progress had been noticed. The wheels rocked and bound even further on the wedges. The wheels would have to come off before they could be got out.
Even so, oxen were powerful beasts. Enough of them would have no problem at all in dragging the cart as well as the barricade. And the nice thing was that people thought of a barricade as something people tried to get into, not out of. Vimes slipped out into the noisy, confusing night. There were soldiers and watchmen and refugees, all cursing at cross purposes. In the flickering shadows, Vimes was just another shape. He pushed his way confidently around the straining oxen and their driver, who was prodding them with a stick. He was heartened by the fact that the man looked the kind of man who'd get 6 out of 10 when answering the question, "What is your name?" Vimes didn't even stop. The important thing was not to let the other person have a chance to say, "But," let alone, "Who the hell do you think you are?" He pushed the man aside and glared at the sweating beasts. "Ah, right, I see your problem right here," he said, in the voice of one who knows everything there is to know about oxen. "They've got the glaggies, but we can fix that. Hold up that one's tail. Hurry up, man." The ox-poker responded to the voice of authority. Vimes palmed a lump of ginger. "Here goes," he thought. "At least it's somewhere warm on a cold night." "Okay, now the other one." "Right. Okay. Now I'll just go around and, just go around," said Vimes, hurrying back into the shadows. He shouldered his way through the throng and dived through a tiny hole. "It's all right, Sarge. I spied you coming through Mrs. Rutherford's dining-room chairs," said Fred Colon, hauling him upright. "Well, you stopped it, Sarge. No mistake. You really...
Yeah, don't shake hands with me until I've had a wash," said Vimes, heading for the pump.
He kept an ear cocked for any strange noises on the other side of the barricade. There were none for several seconds, and then he heard it. Nothing much had happened for some while after his visit to the oxen, except that, very slowly, their eyes had begun to cross, and then, also quite slowly, turn red. It takes a long time for anything to happen inside the head of an ox, but when it does, it happens extensively. The moo started off low and rose slowly. It was a visceral sound that had rolled across the ancient tundra and told early man that here came dinner or death, and either way it was pissed. It was the sound of a big beast that was still too small to restrain all the emotions that were welling up inside it. And it was a duet. Vimes, hauling himself up the barricade, saw people running. Then the whole of Big Mary shuddered. That didn't look too impressive unless you knew that a couple of tons of wood had just jumped sideways. Then there was the sound of splintering. Two of Big Mary's locked wheels collapsed, and she toppled sideways in a mass of flame, splinters, smoke, and dust. Vimes counted under his breath, and had only reached 2 when a cartwheel rolled out of the smoke and away down the road. This always happens. It wasn't over, though. The oxen, tangled in the remains of the shafts and harness, and now an enraged joint creature that could only get 6 legs out of 8 on the ground, headed erratically but with surprising speed in the opposite direction. The other oxen, which had been waiting for the big pull, watched it approach. They were already spooked by the crash, and now they caught the stink of terror and fury and began a slow stampede away from it and towards, as it turned out, the waiting bowmen behind them, who in turn tried to run into the cavalry. The horses were not inclined to be well-behaved towards armed men in any case, and were also in a state of some apprehension. They relieved this by kicking the hell out of anyone close. It was hard for the watchers along the barricade to see much of what happened after that, but the noises were very interesting for quite some time. Sergeant Colon's mouth shut.
"Bloody hell, Sarge," he said admiringly.
In the distance, glass shattered.
"They'll be back," said Vimes. "Yep, but not all of them," said Wiglet. "Well done, Sarge."
Vimes turned and saw Sam staring at him in wide-eyed hero worship.
"I was lucky, lad," he said. "But it helps to remember little details and not mind getting your hands dirty."
"But we could win now, Sarge," said Sam.
"No, we can't. But we can put off losing until it doesn't hurt too much."
Vimes turned to the others.
"Right, lads, back to work. We've had some fun, but dawn's a long way off."
The news had got around even before he'd climbed down from the barricade. There was a cheer from the crowd and a general struttiness about the armed men. "We'd shown them, eh? They don't like the taste of cold steel, those, other people from Ankh-Morpork. We'll show them, eh?" And it had taken a few wedges, some raw ginger, and a lot of luck. That wouldn't happen twice. Maybe it didn't need to. He remembered hearing about the assassination. It was all very mysterious. Winder had been killed in a room full of people, and no one saw a thing.
Magic had been suggested and hotly denied by the wizards. Some historians had said that it happened because troops around the palace had been sent out to attack the barricades, but that didn't answer the question. Anyone who could stab a man to death in a brightly lit room full of people surely wouldn't find some guards in the darkness any kind of obstacle. Of course, with Snapcase as new patrician, no one had tried very hard to establish the facts in any case. People said things like, "Quite possibly we shall never know the truth," which meant, in Vimes's personal lexicon, "I know, or I think I know what the truth is, and hope like hell it doesn't come out because things are all smoothed over now." Supposing we don't lose. Keel hadn't killed Big Mary. She hadn't been used in the other present. The soldiers hadn't been stupid enough to try it. That sort of thing was okay to deal with little local affairs manned by civilians, but it was a joke if you put it up against stout defences manned by professionals. Now she was a wreck. The attackers would have to think of a new plan in a hurry, and time was moving on. Supposing we don't lose. All they had to do was hold out. The people at the top had very short memories. Winder is mysteriously dead, long live Lord Snapcase. And suddenly, all the rebels become glorious freedom fighters, and there's 7 unfilled graves in the cemetery. Would he be able to go back then? Supposing Madam was right and he got offered the post of commander, not as a bribe, but because he'd earned it. That'd change history. He took out the cigar case and stared hard at the inscription. Let's see, he thought. If I never met Sybil, we wouldn't get married, and she wouldn't buy me this, and so I couldn't be looking at it. He stared hard at the curly engraving, almost willing it to disappear. It didn't. On the other hand, that old monk had said that whatever happens, stays happened. And now Vimes had a mental picture of Sybil and Carrot and Detritus and all the rest of them, frozen in a moment that would never have a next moment. He wanted to go home. He wanted it so much that he trembled at the thought. But if the price of that was selling good men to the night, if the price was filling those graves, if the price was not fighting with every trick he knew, then that was too high. It wasn't a decision he was making, he knew that. It was happening far below the areas of the brain that made decisions. It was something built in. There was no universe anywhere where a Sam Vimes would give in on this, because if he did, then he wouldn't be Sam Vimes anymore. The writing stayed on the silver, but it was blurred now because of the tears welling up. They were tears of anger, mostly at himself. There was not a thing that he could do. He hadn't bought a ticket, and he hadn't wanted to come, but now he was on the ride and couldn't get off till the end. What else had the old monk said? History finds a way. Well, it was going to have to come up with something good, because it was up against Sam Vimes now. He glanced up and saw young Sam watching him. You okay, Sarge? Fine, fine. Only you've been sitting there for 20 minutes, looking at your cigars. Vimes coughed and tucked the case away and pulled himself together. Half the pleasure's in the anticipation, he said. The night wore on. News came through from barricades at bridges and gates. There were forays, more to test the defender's strength of will than to make a serious dent in the defences. And there were more deserters. One reason for the desertion rate was that those people of a practical turn of mind were working out the subtle economics. The Republic of Treacle Mine Road lacked all the big, important buildings in the city, the ones that traditional rebels were supposed to take. It had no government offices, no banks, and very few temples. It was almost completely bereft of important civic architecture. All it had was the unimportant stuff. It had the entire slaughterhouse district, and the butter market, and the cheese market. It had the tobacco factors, and the candle makers, and most of the fruit and vegetable warehouses, and the grain and flour stores. This meant that while the Republicans were being starved of important things like government, banking services and salvation, they were self-sufficient in terms of humdrum everyday things like food and drink. People are content to wait a long time for salvation, but prefer dinner to turn up inside an hour. "A present from the lads down at the shambles, Sarge," said Dickens, arriving with a wagon. "They said it'd only spoil otherwise. Is it okay to dish 'em out to the field kitchens?" "What have you got?" said Vimes. "Steaks, mostly," said the old sergeant, grinning. "But I liberated a sack of onions in the name of the revolution." He saw Vimes's expression change. "No, Sarge, the man gave them to me, see? They needed eating," he said. "What did I tell you? Every meal will be a feast in the People's Republic," said Reg Shoe, striding up. He still hung on to his clipboard. People like Reg tend to. "If you could just take it along to the official warehouse, Sergeant." "What warehouse?" Reg sighed.
All food must go to the common warehouse and be distributed by my officials according to...
Mr. Shu, said Dickens, there's a cart with 500 chickens coming up behind me, and there's another full of eggs. There's nowhere to send them, see? The butchers have filled up the ice houses and smoke rooms, and the only place we can store this grub is in our guts. I ain't particularly bothered about officials.
On behalf of the Republic, I order you, Reg began, and Vimes put his hand on his shoulder.
Off you go, Sergeant, he said, nodding to Dickens.
A word in your ear, Reg.
Is this a military coup?
Said Reg uncertainly, holding his clipboard.
No, it's just that we're under siege here, Reg. This is not the time. Let Sergeant Dickens sort it out. He's a fair man, he just doesn't like clipboards.
But supposing people get left out, said Reg.
There's enough for everyone to eat themselves sick, Reg.
Reg Shu looked uncertain and disappointed, as though this prospect was less pleasing than carefully rationed scarcity.
But I'll tell you what, said Vimes. If this goes on, the city will make sure the deliveries come in by other gates. We'll be hungry then. That's when we'll need your organisational skills.
You mean we'll be in a famine situation? Said Reg, the light of hope in his eyes.
If we aren't, Reg, I'm sure you could organise one, said Vimes, and realised he'd gone just a bit too far.
Reg was only stupid in certain areas, and now he looked as though he was going to cry.
I just think it's important to be fair, the man began.
Yeah, Reg, I understand. But there's a time and a place, you know? Maybe the best way to build a bright new world is to peel some spuds in this one. Now off you go. And you, Lance Constable Vimes, you go and help him.
Vimes climbed back up the barricade. The city beyond was dark again, with only the occasional chink of light from a shuttered window. By comparison, the streets of the Republic were ablaze. In a few hours, the shops out there were expecting deliveries, and they weren't going to arrive. The government couldn't sit this one out. A city like Ankh-Morpork was only 2 meals away from chaos at the best of times. Every day, maybe 100 cows died for Ankh-Morpork. So did a flock of sheep, and a herd of pigs, and the gods alone knew how many ducks, chickens, and geese. Flour? He'd heard it was 80 tons, and about the same amount of potatoes, and maybe 20 tons of herring. He didn't particularly want to know this kind of thing, but once you started having to sort out the everlasting traffic problem, these were facts that got handed to you. Every day, 40,000 eggs were laid for the city. Every day, hundreds. Thousands of carts and boats and barges converged on the city with fish and honey and oysters and olives and eels and lobsters. And then think of the horses dragging this stuff, and the windmills, and the wool coming in too every day, the cloth, the tobacco, the spices, the ore, the timber, the cheese, the coal, the fat, the tallow, the hay, every damn day. And that was now. Back home, the city was twice as big. Against the dark screen of night, Vimes had a vision of Ankh-Morpork. It wasn't a city. It was a process. A weight on the world that distorted the land for hundreds of miles around. People who'd never see it in their whole life nevertheless spent their life working for it. Thousands and thousands of green acres were part of it. Forests were part of it. It drew in and consumed, and gave back the dung from its pens, and the soot from its chimneys, and steel, and saucepans, and all the tools by which its food was made, and also clothes, and fashions, and ideas, and interesting vices, songs, and knowledge, and something which, if looked at in the right light, was called civilization. That's what civilization meant. It meant the city. Was anyone else out there thinking about this? A lot of the stuff came in through the Onion Gate and the Shambling Gate, both now Republican and solidly locked. There'd be a military picket on them, surely. Right now, there were carts on the way that'd find those gates closed to them. Yet no matter what the politics, eggs hatch and milk sours and herds of driven animals need penning and watering, and where was that going to happen? Would the military sort it out? Well, would they? While the carts rumbled up, and then they were hemmed in by the carts behind, and the pigs escaped and the cattle herds wandered off? Was anyone important thinking about this? Suddenly, the machine was wobbling. But Winder and his cronies didn't think about the machine. They thought about money. Meat and drink came from servants. They happened. Vetinari, Vimes realized, thought about this sort of thing all the time. The Ankh-Morpork back home was twice as big and 4 times as vulnerable. He wouldn't have let something like this happen. Little wheels must spin so that the machine can turn, he'd say. But now, in the dark, it all spun on Vimes. If the man breaks down, it all breaks down, he thought. The whole machine breaks down, and it goes on breaking down, and it breaks down the people. Behind him, he heard a relief squad marching down Hero Street. How do they rise? They rise knees up, knees up, knees up. They rise knees up high, all the little angels. For a moment, Vimes wondered, looking out through a gap in the furniture, if there wasn't something in Fred's idea about moving the barricades on and on, like a sort of sieve, street by street. You could let through the decent people and push the bastards, the rich bullies, the wheelers and dealers in people's fates, the leeches, the hangers-on, the brown noses and the courtiers and smarmy plump devils in expensive clothes, all those people who didn't know or care about the machine but stole its grease, push them into a smaller and smaller compass and then leave them in there. Maybe you could toss some food in every couple of days, or maybe you could leave them to do what they've always done, which was live off other people. There wasn't much noise from the dark streets. Vimes wondered what was going on. He wondered if anyone out there was taking care of business. Major Mountjoy Standfast stared empty-eyed at the damn map. How many, then? He said.
32 men injured, sir, and another 20 probably desertions, said Captain Wrangle. And Big Mary is firewood, of course.
Oh, gods.
Do you want to hear the rest, sir?
There's more.
I'm afraid there is, sir. Before the remains of Big Mary left Hero Street, sir, she smashed 20 shop windows and various carts, doing damage estimated at...
Fortunes of war, Captain, we can't help that.
No, sir, the captain coughed. Do you want to know what happened next, sir?
Next? There was next? Said the Major.
Yes, sir. Quite a lot of next, actually, sir. The three gates through which most of the agricultural produce comes into the city are picketed, sir, on your orders, so the carters and drovers are bringing their stuff in along Short Street, sir. Fortunately, not too many animals at this time of night, sir, but there were 6 miller's wagons, 1 wagon of, dried fruits and spices, 4 dairymen's wagons and 3 heglers' carts, all wrecked, sir. Those oxen really were very feisty, sir.
Hegglers? What the hell are hegglers? Said the Major, bewildered.
Egg marketers, sir. They travel around the farms, pick up the eggs.
Yes, all right. And what are we supposed to do?
We could make an enormous cake, sir.
Tom?
Sorry, sir. But the city doesn't stop, you see. It's not like a battlefield. The best place for urban fighting is right out in the countryside, sir, where there's nothing else in the way.
It's a bloody big barricade, Tom. Too well defended. We can't even set fire to the damn thing. It'd take the city up with it.
Yes, sir. And the point is, sir, that they're not actually doing anything, sir, except being there.
What do you mean?
They're even putting old grannies up on the barricades, shouting down to the lads. Poor Sergeant Franklin, sir, his granny saw him and said that if he didn't turn it up, she'd tell everyone what he did when he was 11, sir.
The men are armed, aren't they? Said the Major, wiping his forehead.
Oh, yes. But we've kind of advised them not to shoot unarmed old ladies, sir. We don't want another Dolly Sisters, do we, sir?
The Major stared at the map.
There was a solution, he felt.
Well, what did Sergeant Franklin do when he was, he said absent-mindedly.
She didn't say, sir.
A sudden feeling of relief stole over the Major. Captain, you know what this is now?
I'm sure you'll tell me, sir.
I will, Tom, I will. This is political, Tom. We're soldiers. Political goes higher up.
You're right, sir. Well done, sir.
Dig out a lieutenant who's been a bit slack lately and send him up to tell their lordships, said the Major.
Isn't that a bit cruel, sir?
Of course it is. This is politics now.
Lord Albert Salarchi didn't much like parties. There was too much politics, and he particularly didn't like this one because it meant he was in the same room as Lord Winder, a man who deep down he believed to be a bad sort. In his personal vocabulary, there was no greater condemnation. What made it worse was that while seeking to avoid him, he also had to try at the same time to avoid Lord Venturi. Their families cordially detested one another. Lord Albert wasn't sure now what event in history had caused the rift, but it must have been important, obviously, otherwise it would be silly to go on like this. Had the Salarchi and the Venturi been hill clans, they would have been a feud-in and a fight-in. Since they were two of the city's leading families, they were chillingly, viciously, icily polite to each other whenever social fate forced them together. And right now his careful orbit of the less dangerously political areas of the damn party had brought him face to face with Lord Charles Venturi.
It was bad enough having to campaign with the fellow, he thought, without being forced to talk to him over some rather inferior wine, but currently the party's tides offered no way of escape without being impolite. And, curiously, upper-class etiquette in Ankh-Morpork held that, while you could snub your friends any time you felt like it, it was the height of bad form to be impolite to your worst enemy.
"Venturi,"
he said, raising his glass a carefully calculated fraction of an inch.
"Salace,"
said Lord Venturi, doing the same thing.
"This is a party," said Albert.
"Indeed, I see you are standing upright."
"Indeed, so are you, I see."
"Indeed, indeed. On that subject, I note many others are doing the same thing."
"Which is not to say that the horizontal position does not have its merits when it comes to, for example, sleeping," said Albert.
"Quite so. Obviously, that would not be done here."
"Oh, indeed, indeed."
The Salacci and the Venturi made a point, on occasions like this, to talk only about things on which there was no possibility of disagreement. Given the history of the two families, this had become a very small number of things. A brisk lady in a magnificent purple dress advanced across the ballroom floor, her smile travelling in front of her.
"Lord Salacci," she said, proffering her hand, "I hear you have been doing sterling work defending us from the mob."
His lordship, on social automatic pilot, bowed stiffly. He wasn't used to forward women, and this one was all forward. However, all safe topics of conversation with the Venturi had been exhausted.
"I fear you have the advantage of me, madam," he murmured.
"I certainly expect so," said madam, giving him such a radiant smile that he didn't analyze her actual words. "And who is this imposing military gentleman? A comrade in arms?"
Lord Salacci floundered. He'd been brought up knowing that you always introduced men to women, and this smiling lady hadn't told him her...
"Lady Roberta Mezzarole," she said. "Most people who know me call me madam, but my friends call me Bobby."
Lord Venturi clicked his heels. He was quicker on the uptake than his comrade in arms, and his wife told him more of the current gossip.
"Ah, you must be the lady from Genua," he said, taking her hand. "I have heard so much about you."
"Anything good?" said madam.
His lordship glanced across the room. His wife appeared to be deep in conversation. He knew to his cost that her wifely radar could fry an egg half a mile away, but the champagne had been good.
"Mostly expensive," he said,
which didn't sound quite as witty as he intended. She laughed anyway. Perhaps I was witty, he thought. I say, this champagne really is excellent.
"A woman has to make her way in the world as best she can," she said. "May I make so bold as to ask if there is a Lord Mezzarole?" he said. "So early in the evening," said madam, and laughed again.
Lord Venturi found himself laughing with her. "My word," he told himself, "this wit is a lot easier than I thought."
"No, of course, I meant," he began.
"I'm sure you did," said madam, tapping him lightly with her fan. "Now, I mustn't monopolize you, but I really must drag both of you away to talk to some of my friends."
She took Lord Venturi by the unresisting arm and piloted him across the floor. Salacci followed morosely, being of the opinion that when respectable women called themselves Bobby, the world was about to end and ought to.
"Mr. Carter has extensive interest in copper, and Mr. Jones is very interested in rubber," she whispered.
There were about six men in the group, talking in low voices. As their lordships approached, they caught.
"And at a time like this, one really must ask oneself where one's true loyalties lie. Oh, good evening, madam."
On her apparently random walk to the buffet table, madam happened to meet several other gentlemen and, like a good hostess, piloted them in the direction of other small groups. Probably only someone lying on the huge beams that spanned the hall high above would spot any pattern, and even then they'd have to know the code. If they had been in a position to put a red spot on the heads of those people who were not friends of the patrician, and a white spot on those who were his cronies, and a pink spot on those who were perennial waverers, then they would have seen something like a dance taking place. There were not many whites. They would have seen that there were several groups of reds, and white spots were being introduced into them in ones or twos if the number of reds in the group was large enough. If a white left a group,
He or she was effortlessly scooped up and shunted into another conversation, which might contain one or two pinks, but was largely red. Any conversation entirely between white spots was gently broken up with a smile and an, "Oh, but now you must meet," or was joined by several red spots. Pinks, meanwhile, were delicately passed from red group to red group until they were deeply pink, and then they were allowed to mix with other pinks of the same hue under the supervision of a red. In short, the pinks met so many reds and so few whites that they probably forgot about whites at all, while the whites, constantly alone or hugely outnumbered by reds or deep pinks, appeared to be going red out of embarrassment or a desire to blend in. Lord Winder was entirely surrounded by reds, leaving the few remaining whites out in the cold. He looked like all the patricians tended to look after a certain time in office, unpleasantly plump, with the pink jowliness of a man of normal build who had too much rich food. He was sweating slightly in this quite cool room, and his eyes swiveled this way and that, looking for the flaws, the clues, the angles. At last, Madame reached the buffet, where Dr. Follett was helping himself to the devilled eggs, and Miss Rosemary Palm was debating with herself as to whether the future should contain strange pastry things with a green filling that hinted mysteriously of prawn.
"And how are we doing, do you think?" said Dr. Follett, apparently to a swan carved out of ice.
"We are doing well," Madame told a basket of fruit. "There's four, however, that are still proving awkward."
"I know them," said the doctor. "They'll fall into place, trust me. What else can they do? We're used to this game here. We know that if you complain too loudly when you lose, you might not be asked to play again. But I shall station some stout friends near them, just in case their resolve needs a little bolstering."
"He is suspicious," said Miss Palm.
"When isn't he?" said Dr. Follett. "Go and talk to him."
"Where is our new best friend, Doctor?" said Madame.
"Mr. Snapcase is dining quietly but visibly in impeccable company some way away."
They turned when the double doors opened, so did several of the other guests, and then turned back hastily. But it was only a servant, who hurried over to Madame and whispered something. She indicated the two military commanders, and the man went over to hover anxiously beside them. There was a brief exchange, and then, without even a bow towards Lord Winder, all three men went out.
"I shall just go and see to the arrangements," said Madame, and without in any sense following the men, headed towards the doors.
When she stepped into the hall, the two servants waiting by the cake stopped lounging and snapped to attention, and a guard who was patrolling the corridor gave her a quick glance of interrogation.
"Now, Madame," said one of the servants. "What? Oh, no, just wait."
She glided over to where the commanders were in animated conversation with a couple of junior officers, and took Lord Venturi's arm.
"Oh, dear, Charles, are you leaving us so soon?"
Lord Venturi didn't think of wondering how she knew his first name. The champagne had been plentiful, and he saw no reason at the moment why any attractive woman of a certain age shouldn't know his name.
"Oh, there are one or two pockets of resistance left," he said. "Nothing to concern you, madam."
"Bloody big pocket," murmured Lord Sir Archie into his moustache.
"They destroyed Big Mary, sir," said the luckless messenger, "and they—" "Major Mountjoy Standfast can't outthink a bunch of gormless watchmen and civilians and some veterans with garden forks," said Lord Venturi,
who had no idea of how much damage a garden fork could do if hurled straight down from an elevation of 20 feet.
"That's just it, sir. They are veterans, and they know all—" "And the civilians, unarmed civilians," said Venturi.
The messenger, who was a sub-lieutenant and very nervous, couldn't find the right words to explain that "unarmed civilian" was stretching a point, when it was a 200-pound slaughterhouse man with a long hook in one hand and a flensing knife in the other. Young men who joined up for the uniforms and a bed all to themselves did not expect that kind of treatment.
Permission to speak freely, sir,
he tried.
Very well. The men haven't got the heart for it, sir. They'd kill a Clatchian in a wink, sir, but, well, some of the old soldiers are from the regiment, sir, and they're shouting down all kinds of stuff. A lot of the men come from down there, and it's not good for them. And what some of the old ladies shout, sir, well, I've never heard such language. Dolly's sisters is bad enough, sir, but this is a bit too much. Sorry, sir.
Their lordships looked out the window. There was half a regiment in the palace grounds, men who'd had nothing to do for several days but stand guard.
Some backbone and a quick thrust, said Sir Archie. That's what's needed, by Io. Lance the boil. This is not a cavalry action, Venturi. And I'll take those men, fresh blood.
Sir Archie,
"'We do have orders.'
"'We have all kinds of orders,' said Solachi. "'But we know where the enemy is, don't we? "'Aren't there enough guards here? "'How many guards does one fool need?'
"'We can't just—'
Lord Venturi began, but Madame said, "'I'm sure Charles will see that no harm comes to his lordship.' And she took his arm. "'He does have his sword, after all.' A few minutes later, Madame glanced out the window and saw that the troops were quietly moving out. She also noticed, after watching for some time, that the guard patrolling in the hall seemed to have vanished.